Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to our presentation. This is ISO 9001:2015, an introduction to the world's most popular standard. My name is Joseph Krolikowski. I am the QMS Program Manager for Perry Johnson Registrars. Couple of notes for our participants today. All of you are on mute, but we absolutely want to address any questions that you have, so please utilize the question portion of the dashboard. We will address your questions at the conclusion of the presentation. One of the more common questions that we get is whether or not the presentation will be made available after we're finished. We will be providing the slides for download shortly after we're finished, about a day or two. And this presentation, if you want to watch it again with voiceover, it will also be hosted on our YouTube page, which you can access through the pjr.com website. Our topics for today, we're going to address what the ISO 9001 standard is, what it's positioned for, and we're going to primarily approach that by deconstructing the scope statement and kind of take it piece by piece. We're going to have a little bit of discussion on where the standards come from, ISO standards. We'll discuss the impact of Annex SL, which is the high-level outline. I'm going to give you a very brief walk through the standard, kind of cover to cover, give you a sense of what's where. I have a longer section on key ideas that are brought out of ISO 9001. A couple concluding remarks, and then your questions. So what is ISO 9001? Well, ISO 9001's official title is Quality Management Systems-Requirements. So you could potentially read that as Requirements for Quality Management Systems. Now, the intent of the standard, what it's all about, is provided in Section 1. Section 1 is called Scope. Now, the verbiage in this section has been the same for the past three editions of ISO 9001, 2000, 2008, and now 2015. They all say essentially, or not essentially, they all say exactly the same thing in the scope portion. And that portion reads as follows. This international standard specifies requirements for a quality management system when an organization needs to demonstrate its ability to consistently provide products and services that meet customer and applicable statutory regulatory requirements and aims to enhance customer satisfaction through the effective application of the system, including processes for improvement of the system and the assurance of conformity to customer and applicable statutory and regulatory requirements. Now that's kind of a mouthful. So why don't we take that in smaller bites? And let's start with this phrase, this international standard specifies requirements for a quality management system. The opening declaration establishes a very key aspect, and that is that this standard is all about a system. It's not a product standard. It does not intend in any way, shape, or form to define how products are manufactured or how services are rendered. Any organization that gets certified to ISO 9001 is still expected to define for itself how the products are going to be made, how the services will be rendered, and so forth. It's not a product standard. The scope then continues. When an organization needs to demonstrate its ability to consistently provide products and services. Now this brings up another key aspect. The fact that ISO 9001 is considered a mutually applicable standard for both products and services. Now, if you go back to the early revisions of ISO 9001, because of simply of how it was written, The presumption was that it was strictly a product standard, a manufacturing standard. The intent was always that it would be equally beneficial to service-based organizations, and now it's been written in such a way that that is the case. That meet customer and applicable statutory and regulatory requirements and aims to enhance customer satisfaction. And this brings out probably the central cornerstone of ISO 9001 itself. And that is that any organization that's ISO 9001 certified needs to be attuned, receptive, and responsive to the needs of their customer. They need to be paying very close attention to what their customers are telling them. Through the effective application of the system, including processes for improvement of the system and the assurance of conformity to customer and applicable statutory regulatory requirements. Now, this last bit acknowledges the ongoing nature of a system. It's not just something that you implement and forget about. And furthermore, they've added the term improvement. Improvement, as we're going to learn, is prevalent throughout the standard. So in terms of where these standards come from, the ISO is the English translation for a term International Organization for Standardization, which comes out IOS, but in its native language, it does come across as ISO. And who ISO is? They're a collective. They are made up of numerous international members. And every standard that ISO writes, and they write thousands of standards, is assigned to a technical committee. So for ISO 9001, the technical committee is TC-176. And TC-176 itself includes members from all the major industrialized nations. Now here in the United States, our representatives to TC-176 are drawn from the American National Standards Institute, or ANSI. So to understand how ISO 9001 2015 is organized and what's where and why it's ordered in the manner that it is, you first have to understand a key document that was developed 3 years before ISO 9001 2015 was published, and that is Annex SL. Now, Annex SL, you may hear referred to as the high-level outline, Annex XL, and so forth. It is part of a larger ISO publication called Directives Part 1, Consolidated ISO Supplement. This is a standard on how to write standards. It's a self-imposed document that the ISO utilizes when it develops standards. And it's actually public domain. If you go to the ISO.org website and do a search, you can find Directives Part 1 and Annex SL and read it for yourself. Now, as I said, it was written back in 2012, and it represented the output of a special committee called the Joint Technical Coordination Group. Now, what they wanted to accomplish with this Annex SL was to provide a 10-section blueprint for writing the ISO family of standards. And the intent here was that if they had common terms and core definitions and core verbiage even, it would permit the writers of the standards and the users of the standards especially to have harmony. So if you have an ISO 9001 2015 system, you can easily add ISO 14000 or ISO 37001 or any other standard to your system without having to write a whole new set of documentation. The clauses, the terms, all of these things are common. That was the big picture with what they were trying to accomplish with Annex SL. Now, just about every standard that the ISO writes has completed its transition. It's been updated. Now, some are still in the midst of the transition deadlines. ISO 45001, for example, their transition deadline is up ahead. But the larger picture here is that we're nearly there with all of these standards transitioning. And there's obviously going to be new standards in the future, but the big picture is that these new standards and current standards and content has all been updated. Here's an example of how it works with AnnexSL. On the left-hand side here, we've got the AnnexSL verbiage for section 9.2.1, which is internal audits. And you can see the X's in a couple of places. The organization shall conduct internal audits at planned intervals to provide information on whether the et cetera management system. Well, obviously for ISO 9001, we're gonna fill in those et ceteras with quality. So the X's become quality in ISO 9001, and you'll also note the verbiage for subclause 2, the requirements of this international standard. You can see how AnnexSL provides the framework, and then when you write the actual standard, we fill in that common verbiage. Okay, so AnnexSL provides a 10-section structure, and seven of those sections are auditable. So I want to put these up in front of you to begin with and just kind of very quickly walk you through the seven auditable sections. They begin with section four. Section four is called context, and it provides a couple of high-level items, getting understanding of interested parties, what's the scope of your system, what are your processes. These are things that are covered in section four. Section five is called leadership and commitment. We have the quality policy is captured here. Customer focus is captured here, establishing responsibility and authority. In section six, we have the primary placeholder for risks, and we also have the quality objectives. So there's two primary pieces at play here. Section seven is called support. There's actually a lot in section seven. This is where you'll find your document control requirements. Communication is covered here. Competency is covered here. Calibration is even covered here. Section eight is the largest of the sections. And in terms of auditor time during the audit, the bulk of it will be spent in section eight. This is going to be all of your day-to-day stuff. Selling the product, designing the product, interfaces with suppliers, controlling production, all of that is covered in section eight. The standard then concludes with sections nine and 10. Section nine covers things like internal audit, management review. These are all the various evaluation techniques that are mandated. And then section 10 is called, of course, improvement. How do we seek improvement, both continual improvement and otherwise? So with that in mind, let's do a more thorough cover to cover and explore some of the other things that are included in the ISO 9001 standard. ISO 9001 starts with an introduction section. And under subclause 0.1, we have a general statement. This general statement provides an overview. It gives some indication on who the standard benefits, talks about risk-based thinking, PDCA, that stands for Plan, Do, Check, Act. Plan, Do, Check, Act is kind of a large overarching idea on the standard itself and how it's laid out. And section 0.1 also explains four key terms that are used in the standard and are getting defined actually for the first time, three of them. We have, first of all, shall. And for any of you that have worked with past versions of ISO 9001, I'm sure you are well familiar with the term shall. That means a mandatory requirement, something that if you don't do, you can be written up for it during an audit. 0.1 also talks about a term called should. This is a recommendation. There's actually no instances of should within the auditable content. All of what you read in the auditable content is strictly shalls. Now, that's not the case with every other standard, but it is the case for ISO 9001. We also have the term may, which indicates a permission. That term appears once in the auditable content. And then we also have can, as far as a possibility or a capability. And the term can is used several times. The introduction continues with an acknowledgement of the seven quality management principles. Now, the seven quality management principles are officially found in the ISO 9000 standard. ISO 9000 is fundamentals in vocabulary, and it talks about the big picture with what ISO is really written about. And these seven principles are all introduced and discussed at some length. And right at the top, unsurprisingly, is customer focus. The whole idea that what we do with an eye on our customers and ensuring that their needs and expectations are met. Leadership and engagement of people are linked ideas. The whole idea that leadership leads and is very much involved in the system. We're going to see some of that a little bit later in the presentation. Engagement of people, this idea that everyone in the system is involved, plays a role in contributing to the success of the ISO 9001 system. We'll be digging into both process, approach, and improvement a little bit later in the presentation, so I'm going to skip past those for just a second. I want to mention briefly with evidence-based decision making, this is very much a link back to the ideas that are raised in Section 9, the whole idea that you do not take action or make decisions in an ISO 9001 system without having facts, without having a set of data upon which to base those decisions. And then relationship management refers to the various relationships that you have with outside parties. Now, this could be suppliers, this could be your parent company, this could be anyone that is going to have an influence on your quality management system and its success or failure. Process approach is mentioned in section 0.3. This is the reinforcement of not just the process approach, but also the plan, do, check, act cycle. And there's an improved graphic that's given. And I want to jump ahead here to 0.33, which is risk-based thinking. Risk-based thinking is a very big concept in the standard, and risk actually has its own section. We'll be tackling that when we get to Annex A. 0.4 establishes the relationship that ISO 9001 has with both the ISO 9000 fundamentals document and the 9004, which is guidelines and guidance on improvement. Excuse me. Getting into the numbered sections, we have Section 1 scope, which we have already reviewed. Section 2 is called normative reference. This establishes an official link to the 9000 fundamentals and vocabulary standard. And what this does is it establishes that the terms and definitions that are used in 9000 are binding in an audit context. Now, that sounds heavy duty, but most of the definitions that appear in the 9000 standard are deliberately open. So there are a few where things are very much nailed down. Correction and corrective action are two good examples of that. But in either case, this normative reference establishes that those definitions are binding in an audit context. Section 3 is terms and definitions. Now, interestingly, for the 9000 standard, There are no official terms and definitions. We rely solely on the ones that are provided in the 9000 document. Now, that may change in the future. That's certainly possible. But for the moment, there are no terms that are unique to ISO 9000 that don't already appear in the 9000 document. I beg your pardon, in 9001. Now, we've already gone over sections 4 through 10, so I want to jump ahead to the back end of the standard and begin with Annex A. For those of you that have newly purchased ISO 9001 2015, I definitely want to encourage you to become familiar with Annex A. It's a very useful part of the standard. And again, because it's written into the standard, it is binding in the context of an audit. Annex A1 is called Structure and Terminology. All of what's in Annex A is guidance. It's unique in that there are very few standards where there is guidance written right into the standard. So in A1, we have a paragraph that essentially says, if you, the organization, don't wish to align your documentation to match ISO 9001, so, for example, if you have a procedure for purchasing and you don't want to number that procedure 8.4, fine. You can number your procedure however you want. That should not be an issue on audit day. And it also says you don't even have to use the specific terms that are found in the standard. Good example of that would be if you want to refer to them as suppliers. Well, that's fine too. Just because ISO 9001 refers to those parties as external providers, that doesn't suddenly mean that you have to start calling them external providers. So you get the idea. We want to make sure that you're comfortable and confident that you can number procedures and other things however you want, and you can use terminology that makes sense to you. In A2, there's an explanation of the intent in referencing products and services side by side throughout the standard. A3 talks about interested parties, gives a little bit more of an explanation of what interested parties are all about and who they include. A4 is called risk-based thinking. This is a very important little bit of writing in the standard. It specifically mentions that a formal structure, a formal process for risk management is not required. That's key. I've actually seen that come up on audit day sometimes. Misinformed auditors telling their auditees that they have to have a risk management process. You don't. That's not the way that the standard has been written. A5 is called applicability. It refers to the removal of the term exclusions. This was a term that was used in the prior versions of ISO 9001, and it gets into this new idea of non-applicable clauses. A6 is called documented information, and it gives some discussion on the terms procedure, record, and document, why those terms are no longer used, and the phrases that have replaced those terms. A7 is called organizational knowledge. This was another, similar to risk, another new idea that was introduced with 9001, so it warranted its own explanation. And then finally, we have A8, which is called control of externally provided products and services. And this gives us some idea of who we're referring to and how those controls are supposed to work. Annex B is some further discussion on the relationship between 9001 and the other ISO publications, things like 9004, 10001, and so forth. And then the standard concludes with a bibliography. Now, if you take ISO 9001 in its purest sense, if you take the auditable portion of ISO 9001, my analysis and my experience with it tells me that there are five key ideas in play in terms of what they've written into the standard and what the expectations are. And those ideas are scope, processes, accountability, effectiveness, and improvement. So I want to explore these ideas. I want to give you the causal linkages. I want to help you understand what are they going after with some of these big ideas, and why are some of these requirements written in the manner that they are. So let's begin with scope. Now, in section 4.3, very early on in the standard, there is a requirement that the organization develops what's referred to as a scope statement. Now, a scope statement represents what am I getting certified for? What is it that I do that I need ISO certification for? So here's a couple of examples. You know, let's say that you are a design responsible company. So design, fabrication, and assembly of collapsible tripods. Maybe you're just a distributor. Distribution of fasteners, distribution of tires, could be anything. Maybe you're just a secondary manufacturing operation. So plating, heat treating, and sorting of metal stampings. Whatever it is that you do that you want the ISO certification for, that needs to be put together in your scope statement. Now, ideally, the scope statement that you develop will eventually be the same as that shown on the certificate that you get from PJR. But a word of caution, when you're developing your scope, do not list an item on your scope that won't be available for audit. A good example of this, if you have as part of your business field installation, now let's say that you're designing and manufacturing a machine of some sort and you're installing it in the field. Well, the only way that we can list field installation on your certificate is if we do a remote audit where you are performing the field installation activity. We can't certify you for something that we can't see. Another example of this would be an organization, let's say that they've added a powder coat line to their manufacturing operation, and they want to add powder coating to their certificate. Well, if the powder coating isn't up and running, we can't certify that process. Again, we cannot certify what we can't see and see in action. Now, I also want to caution all of you to be careful about being too wordy in your scope statement. So let's consider an example here. Let's say that an organization has the following as their scope: laser cutting, water jet cutting, progressive die cutting, plating, heat treating, and distribution of flanges, springs, shims, bolts, and barrels. That's a mouthful. If this is the scope statement that you must have on your certificate, we have to audit laser cutting, water jet cutting, progressive die cutting, plating, heat treating, and distribution. We have to be able to audit all of those operations. And in addition, we also have to audit the following product groups. We have to audit flanges, springs, shims, bolts, and barrels. If you must have it in the scope on the certificate, we have to be able to include it in our audit. So bear that in mind when you're developing the scope statement. If it's possible for you to be succinct in developing the scope statement, and for example, to say manufacturing and distribution, then by all means, do so. Let's move on to our next key idea. The next key idea is processes. This is another item that comes up relatively early in the standard, section 4.4. And the idea here is that you as an organization, you need to determine what your processes are and how they interface with each other. And 4.4 comes right out and says, your organization, your quality management system is made up of processes. Now, this whole idea of processes, this is a very key idea. And it's so important. We actually have a whole separate webinar on it called The Interaction of Processes and Its Importance to a Successful Audit. So if you haven't seen that webinar yet, I definitely encourage you to check it out if you're in the midst of developing a new system. But processes are a big deal in the quality management system. And they come up throughout the standard. Using a process approach is mentioned under leadership in section 5. Aligning your quality objectives to processes, that comes up in section 6.2. Making sure that your staff are competent. When they talk about competency in the standard, they are saying that they need to be competent and available for your processes. So they frame competency under the guise of processes. Ensuring effective infrastructure for your processes. That comes up in section 7.1.3. External processes is mentioned in 8.4. And reviewing process performance. That comes up in section 9.3. So when you're determining what your processes are, we encourage you to make your processes as personal and unique to your business as possible. If it's something that is more familiar to you when you put your system together, it's going to add value to your organization, it's going to help ensure that you understand it, and you'll work at it. You'll own it if you take my meaning. I'm always concerned for companies that are inclined to name their processes after the sections of ISO 9001. I mean, think about it. How many of you have a process that you call control of external providers? I mean, that's robot speak. Maybe some of you have that, but go for process names and designations that make sense to you, that represent what you're truly doing. The third key idea, that I want to discuss today is accountability. Excuse me. ISO 9001 2015, it really demands inclusion. It says that anyone that is in this scope is involved. Everybody has a stake, so to speak. And this is probably no more dramatically made clear than Section 511. Section 511 is entitled Leadership, and it talks about accountability. There's actually a phrase in 511 where it says that management needs to make itself accountable for the effectiveness of the quality management system. Now, this whole idea of accountability comes up in several more places. In 8.6, it says that product release records need to name names. They actually want you to tell us who inspected this product and said it was okay, not just that it was inspected, but by whom. Complaints that come in have to be responded to with systemic action. That comes from Section 10.2. An organization has to define roles and responsibilities. That's in Section 5.3. All personnel need to be aware of the quality policy, 5.2.2b, and also how they contribute to the effectiveness of the quality management system. And that comes from 7.3. So accountability is a big picture idea. Our fourth key idea is effectiveness. There's a lot of requirements in play that require you to measure how effective an activity was. And the idea is that you should know at any given time how well or how poorly things are going in your operation. Now, the basic idea of effectiveness measures is probably most succinctly established in Clause 441C. And I've actually, I mean, the verbiage is so strong, I've actually pulled it right out of the standard. It says that an organization has to determine and apply criteria and methods, which will include monitoring, measuring, and related performance indicators, to ensure the effective operation and control of processes. And on the basis of that alone, you've got a fairly strong vote for monitor the effectiveness. But the standard gets even more specific than that. And we got a whole list of things here. So again, quality objectives, a measure of effectiveness, 6.2.1. Evaluating actions for competency, 7.2. External provider performance, 8.4. Inspecting products, 8.6. Measuring customer satisfaction, 9.12. Doing trending analysis on the system, 9.13. Internal audit assessment, 9.2. Management review, 9.3, and then efforts towards improvement under 10.1. So there's a lot of places in the standard where this big picture idea of effectiveness is put across, and in a very specific fashion. They've got prescriptive things that they want you to do to hit the mark of effectiveness. Excuse me. The final cornerstone concept that I want to explore with you today is improvement. Now, I mentioned this earlier that improvement is it's an extension, an evolution, if you will, of an older idea that was in the 2008 and 2000 versions of the standard called continual improvement. And the viewpoint that they're taking with improvement now is that there's a lot of ways you can achieve improvement. Continual improvement, obviously, but also reacting to things. The idea is that if you react to a negative event, hopefully you do so in such a way that it strengthens the system overall. We have breakthroughs even, reorganizations, lots of things conceptually that contribute to improvement. Improvement is explored primarily in section 10.1 of the standard, where it reads that you will determine and select opportunities for improvement and implement the actions to meet customer requirements and enhance customer satisfaction. Again, this big picture idea that to get to a static level of compliance is not really sufficient in and of itself. You need to be attaining improvement as well. Like so many other things that we've looked at today, improvement is revisited throughout the standard, and it really is prevalent. In section 4.4, it talks about the organization continually improving its system. In 5.1.1, it says that management has to promote improvement. In 5.2.1, it states that the quality policy needs to discuss continual improvement specifically. 5.3c states that assigned responsibilities need to include reporting on opportunities for improvement. 6.1.1d says that your risk actions need to target improvement. 7.1.1 says that your resources need to be positioned that the organization can achieve improvement. 7.3 says that persons that work for the organization should be aware that their efforts impact improvements. And in 9.32F, it says that improvement needs to be among the things discussed in the management review meeting process. So in conclusion, ISO 9001:2015 remains the world's most utilized standard. There are just over 1.3 million registered companies worldwide. Any organization that is seeking certification to ISO 9001 needs to bear in mind what the big picture is of what ISO 9001 is all about. And I'm hopeful that we've accomplished that with our presentation today. Now, if you're ready for a deeper dive, we have a newly launched clause-by-clause primer course where we go through the standard clause by clause and explain everything in detail. What are they talking about here and here and here? The title of that course is ISO 9001:2015, a clause by clause analysis. That course can be found on our website under the training link, and it is 100% free. I'd like to also invite you to tune into one of our other webinars, ISO 9001:2015, Anticipating Auditor Expectations in Key Areas. That one is presented roughly every quarter, kind of picks up from where we left here. It explores some of the more common issues that come up in audits and what's typically expected for those areas. We also have non-applicable clauses, exclusions, exemptions, which will help you excuse me, understand both what can and what cannot be excused in an audit assessment. And then the item I mentioned earlier, our Interaction of Processes webinar, which goes over both processes and the ways to map out processes. We also cover a number of other topics. We have webinars on Stage 1 auditing, IATF 16949, and several other topics. If you'd like to be kept informed of the latest news automatically, the best way for you to do that is to opt in. If you go to our website at www.pjr.com, go to the bottom of the page, enter your email address, and click subscribe. You'll be automatically opted in for updates, new webinars, and other points of information. I do thank you for your time. As I mentioned, copies of this presentation will be made available shortly after we're finished. And if you want to rewatch it, it's available on our YouTube page. If there are any questions at this time, I'll be glad to take them. Again, if you have questions, you can use the question portion of the dashboard. Okay, it would appear that there are no questions today, so I'll say, we do have a question from Maulesh Shah. What is the process if the name of the company changes? Well, that would be handled through the certification body, the registrar that you're working with. You would simply need to inform them, and that would be weighted very much on is it just a company name change or if it's a legal change in the ownership. That's kind of an in-depth item, and that would have to be handled on a case-by-case basis. Toru Kikuchi, I'm glad that you enjoyed the webinar today. Any other questions? Brittany Lofkin asks, what is the best way to understand if you're just starting out? Well, Brittany, I would definitely encourage you to check out the new clause-by-clause course that we've launched on our website. You may also find it beneficial to attend an internal auditor course, whether online or in person. Both of these would help you expand your assessment, your understanding of the standard. Vicky McGee asks, is risk-based thinking and risk assessment the same thing? Not entirely. Risk-based thinking is the phrase that's used by the writers of the standard. Risk assessment is a portion, really, of that process. And that's more of a deep dive of what's covered in section 6.1. So they're related concepts, but not entirely the same. Maxine Campbell asks, what does the sequence and interaction of processes look like? Maxine, I would encourage you to check out our webinar on the interaction of processes and its importance to a successful audit. We have one of those coming up. We also have presented it in the past. If you go on our website, you'll be able to find a past presentation of it where that would help you get a sense of what that document might look like. Any other questions today? Well, I do thank you all again. Have a great weekend.